Welcome to Destiny. Now here's your host, Cliff Dunning.
Hey, how are you doing? I gotta tell you, this has been an interesting week for me. A couple of weeks ago, we had a program with an engineer. Her name was Gail Lynn. You might remember. She was the primary inventor behind this harmonic egg device. And I was so intrigued. In fact, after the interview, I had a chance to speak with her in more depth about some of the effects that people were having. And I was fully ready to get on a plane and fly to Colorado to have an experience with this harmonic egg. Luckily, she has distributed 100 of these eggs throughout the United States and neighboring countries. I think there may be a couple in Europe. But anyhow, there's one that's a few miles south of me here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it is available. And so last Friday, I made an appointment to go down and meet with the operator. Her name is Sylvia, who, by the way, I am going to interview later in the week because I'm going to do a second treatment. And I'm going to talk to her about some of the people that have come in and what the various ailments are or intentions for better lifestyles or whatever. What the different types of conditions and wants and desires are when people come for an experience. But getting back to me, I went not only because I'm interested in these exotic technologies and am a person who has studied native energies. And when I say native, this is like Maya, Hopi, Zuni, sweat lodges, pyramid technology, temple technology, telluric fields. I mean, many, many of the shows, if not all of them, that we have here that deal with energetics are my interest. Or a publisher will say, look, I got a guy who's an engineer, a physician, whoever, who has developed a system, a process, a machine, a device that creates energy, that's a healing device, that's a helpful device, clearing energy, helping the DNA, stuff like that. I'm very much into that, and so we'll have them. But anyhow, long story short, I went to Castro Valley to experience what the system is that powers these harmonic eggs. And I got to tell you, I'm into, what is it, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, today's Tuesday, 4 days into it. And it's funny because I wasn't expecting a lot. Not that I don't need to be detoxed, not that I don't have issues. I'm a physical being, so I'm not pure light. I'm not a soul spirit. I'm a physical being. So yeah, I got accumulated garbage. Emotional, I have problems emotionally. I'm emotionally disturbed. No, I'm like everybody else. I got family issues. My mom's driving me crazy at 93. My family is family, and then I have friends and I have work situations and so on and so forth. So I went in there actually in the hopes and with the intention of getting more energy. And that was it. I was like, my energy seems to be waning and my goal was to increase energy. The funny thing about it is I walked in there and the egg operator, I guess you'll call it, asked me a series of questions. And they need to do that because they need to provide a certain musical frequency and light for your specific issue. And so she asked me questions about my health, state of mind, and things like that. And she's very pleasant. Sylvia is very pleasant. And so I get into this egg. And by the way, there's they call it a zero gravity seat. You get in this chair in the middle of this thing and they tilt it back And all of a sudden, you're facing the ceiling. And so they shut the door. And it's big enough so that you don't feel claustrophobic. Personally, I would have liked to have a little more air in there, a little pumped air. But it was big enough to, you know, to be okay for 50 minutes of activity. So I get in there. They close the door. They tilt this zero gravity chair. I'm facing up. And all of a sudden, after a few minutes, there's a slow background music that's coming up. Very comfortable. And my feeling was that it was very accurately chosen for my situation. So anyhow, here's the music. And then low lights. And then I'm just closing my eyes and relaxing. Now, I meditate twice a day. So I go down to, I think it's called theta, to a deep state fairly quickly. So I went in and I was relaxed, deeply, deeply relaxed. And one of the things that came up was there's a strange smell in the air. And I later learned that this is a form of detoxification. And in their post-treatment, they call it paper, they say you need to drink like a quantity of water. I think it's equal to a couple of, no, it's half gallon maybe or something. I'll read it later when we interview her. But anyhow, you drink water, you don't drink alcohol, you don't have any cannabis, you don't do any kind of heavy physical exercise because you got to let the body relax. Well, I didn't think anything of it until the next day. No, I'll say that night, that Friday night, I woke up a couple of different times. I usually sleep through the night fairly well, but I woke up and that was odd. I woke up twice. And then on Saturday, man, I was dragging and I don't know what was going on, but I felt better when I drank the water. And I kind of use that as a, you know, a form of detoxification because you're flushing your system, you're flushing your kidneys. As it turned out, I was using the bathroom pretty much the whole weekend, and that's because you're flushing your system, you're urinating, you're peeing because you're detoxing. But how in the hell that the system that she developed, this egg shaped system, the harmonic egg, the lights and the sound, how does that trip the body a detox? It's just amazing. And there's subtle stuff going on. I'm fairly aware of my body, so I'm like, what is this? You know, I'm having varying states of strength and weakness. Now, I'm really glad that they say do 60% of your normal exercising because I typically go and do a fairly strenuous hike during the week, and I just didn't feel like doing any hike. I have a treadmill at home. I've been treadmilling for 30 minutes rather than doing a strenuous hike. But I have to say, it does the program is definitely a detoxification. Sylvia said that she had intuited that I needed to have a good DNA reprogramming. I know you, though, those of you in the medical field or who are overeducated are probably going, what are you talking about? What do you mean reprogramming? No, there's nothing on earth that can reprogram you. Oh my God. Well, this is technology. This is a system that we're just at the very basic levels of understanding, if at all. And, you know, if you're a PhD in clinical psychology or you're a clinician of some kind, you're hearing this and going, that's crap. There's no such thing. Yeah, well, this is what we're all about here on Destiny. It's all about introducing and experiencing new forms of healing, new forms of detoxification, and clearing. But one of the things that came up for me, and just because I've decided I needed to write a little bit about what was going on, is we are bombarded by our iPhones, our internet, our TV. And I've discovered, and you know what? If you're on iTunes, or excuse me, iPhone, They have an automated system that will tell you how much time you're spending on the phone, looking at TikTok, looking at YouTube, looking at Instagram, so forth and so on. And I have been in my viewing of this data has increased by 25%, which is really, really bad for me because I'm a writer. I need to have a clear brain. I need to be thinking my you know, original thoughts for my articles, for my podcasts, for Earth Ancients and special edition, the archives, as well as EA, Earth Ancients. So I've discovered that I have to cut back on this because it's burning me out. And not only is it burning me out, it's sensory overload. And this is something that people are becoming addicted to. I mean, people are addicted to their phones. I'm going to do a program on this. I was thinking about this the other day. We're on our damn phones all the time. I was in San Francisco to meet a friend a couple of weeks ago, and I was looking up the main strip is Market Street. That's like the main drag. And everybody who was coming up from the BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit, which is our subway, coming off buses, walking the street, even standing in front of a window, were staring at their damn phones. Nobody is taking in the ambience of the city. And nobody is taking in what they're up to. They're so distracted. And this is a real problem. I think this is a serious, serious problem. And I bet that the psychiatrists, the psychologists, the people who are looking at and measuring people's ability to function are concerned about this. I'm concerned about my ability to function at a peak level, because if my brain is being captured by the TikTok videos, and I got to say, I have not laughed and had more fun than watching TikTok. TikTok is much better than YouTube, much better than Instagram. And I think it's just the system of allowing people to do little video vignettes of a few minutes or more, and people just going wild. So that is great fun. But you know what? We have to watch out for our mental, physical, and spiritual wellness. And this addiction is a problem. And I think this is one of the reasons I'm having these bouts of fatigue, which has been concerning for me, bouts of not having great mental clarity, which is, you know, an issue as you get older. But for me, I've always been kind of a morning person. I get up around 7:30 and, you know, write for a couple hours, and then I do my email response. And then I'll, you know, work with the team and look at the week's podcasts and get the interviews and so forth and so on. But, you know, my energy wanes after around 2 o'clock, and it used to be good up until like 5 or 6. It could be, it's just an age related thing, but I have noticed that I'm just not as locked in. And I think the problem is that I'm burning out with the stimulation, and this is it. Over stimulation of our brains with these devices. So I think my big takeaway from this harmonic egg was clarity on some of more of my weaknesses, but also, and again, we're going to hear from Sylvia, who is in Castro Valley, California, who operates one of these harmonic eggs. We're going to ask her about some of the different symptoms that people come and the results. I can say for a fact that it's uncanny how this egg experience has affected me. So I'm going to go for 2 more sessions, one this Friday and then a follow-up the following Friday, and we'll see what happens. But I got to say, the follow-up, the post-treatment sheet on what to do and what not to do is very, very helpful, because I think I would be, you know, fairly exhausted, if not worse, if I were to try to do a strenuous hike or go to the gym pump weights and do some heavy cardio. I think, and I don't have it in front of me, I'll talk about it when we have Sylvie on the program next week. I think it's also suggested that you dial down your interactions, especially with people that are causing stress. So that could be anything. It could be your spouse, could be family. And you know how it is. If you're married or you're in a committed relationship, you can have stressful days, and that can wreak havoc on you. So anyhow, look on Earth Ancients, the Facebook page. I'm going to post two photographs of the harmonic egg. One has a picture of Sylvie in the background. And we'll talk more about it and talk about where this technology came from. It's not in any document. I think they're beginning to consider writing some scientific papers on it just to say this is what we are getting. I'm waiting to hear about the FDA. Now, the FDA is the federal oversight for anybody coming up with new vitamins, new treatments of wellness, specifically, and this would include the harmonic egg. They're likely to look at this, especially if somebody goes into one of these chambers and has a healing, a significant healing where they start having cancer healed or nervous disorder, MS healed. And I've heard rumors about people with serious neurological disorders going into one of these eggs and coming out feeling not only a lot better, but over time having significant remissions. So when you start pushing, not, I shouldn't say pushing, but when you start advertising that this is good for a lot of healing, the FDA is going to pop up and go, what are you doing? You know, because God help us if somebody were to invent a treatment or a program, a natural program to remiss or to treat cancer, which is the biggest money hog in the whole country. The treatments are unheardedly expensive. If the harmonic egg turns out to be this great tool for healing significant degenerative disease, then the FDA will step in and go, okay, we need to have some studies on this. We need to see you need to qualify, whatever, what you're doing. And we'll talk about this next time, but there's been a couple of major scientific inventions by in some cases doctors, in some cases well-respected scientists who were able to change the cellular level, cellular composition of cancer and remiss people with advanced stage cancer, and they were shut down. They were immediately shut down because we can't have that. So remember, cancer is business. Allopathic medicine is business. And I've said this many times. When you go to your doctor, he is there to treat you, but he's also a businessman, and he wants to treat you with drugs and provide you surgical procedures, among other therapies that fall under allopathy. And remember that allopathy is drugging, surgical procedures, and in some cases radiation. That is their treatment plan for your illness. So, I've predicted this many years, and believe me, and I fought with my grandfather before he passed away. My grandfather was a gynecological surgeon. And he was a GP, then he was into surgery. But my cousin's I have medical people on my mother's side, and I fight with them all. There's going to be a time when we're going to look at the treatments provided to us, and I'm talking about the United States, and we'll look back, and this will be in our lifetime, at least my lifetime. We'll look back and go, what the hell were we thinking? We were poisoning people. We were killing people with this therapy. Who in the hell came up with this? And it's beginning to happen now. I'm beginning to see doctors, in fact, even university professors who teach undergrad classes, pre-med, and also, you know, trained doctors, they're thinking and they're talking, they're becoming outspoken that this is not working anymore. We can't use this form of therapy to treat common illnesses, common disturbances. So I've been harping on this for 30 years. When I was the program director for Whole Life, we had regular scientists come in who had new therapies, new techniques for wellness, and some of them would advance, but a lot of them didn't, simply because they were stopped by the FDA. It's just, I mean, there's horror stories of people who are trying to come up with wellness systems that are not allopathically focused, and they're just being harassed and shut down, and sometimes worse. So anyhow, that's my two cents. All right, so today's program is The Dreaming Circus. My guest is Jim Morrison. This is a former major in the Army. He was a special ops serviceman who served in Vietnam. And the book is based on his path to Toltec wisdom. He began seeing the light. It's kind of cool, kind of a cool interview, because he begins experimenting with LSD, with peyote, with a lot of other plant medicines to shift his awareness. Now, we hear a lot about the 60s and what people were doing. There's a lot of drugs that became very vogue to take, and LSD was one of them. So we're going to hear his journey, and we're going to understand a little bit about what he undertook after being a soldier, being severely wounded, and then coming back, shifting his perspective with plant medicines, and then what happened after that. So again, our program today is The Dreaming Circus with my guest, Jim Morris. Interesting guest this week. He has fought in the Vietnam War. He has gone through emotional, I should just call it body, mind, and spirit transformations. Some of it good, some of it not so good. And in his book that we're going to talk about today, he actually has what I can consider a transformation. As a seeker, as a person who's looking for inner development and wisdom, his journey is amazing. My guest today is retired Major Jim Morris. He served three tours of the Green Beret in Vietnam. He's a civil rights advocate. He's quite a writer. He wrote a Vietnam memoir called War Story, a number of nonfiction articles. He's covered the war for Rolling Stone magazine, Soldier of Fortune. God, I don't even know if Soldier of Fortune's still around. I haven't seen it. Saturday Evening Post. And he has steeped himself, or as he calls it, immersed himself in the study of Toltec shamanism. And Jim's coming to us today from Bell Canyon, California. The book we're talking about today is called The Dreaming Circus, Special Ops, LSD, and My Unlikely Path to Toltec Wisdom. It's a great title. Hey, Jim, welcome to Destiny. Great to have you.
It's good to be here.
All right. I got to ask you, I just missed getting recruited into the service for the Vietnam War, but three tours of duty, that's hellish. What's that all about?
Well, I was in the Army when the Vietnam War started, and I had three Purple Hearts before the first anti-war protest.
Jesus.
And also by that time I had more friends in Vietnam than I had any place else.
Yeah.
So it was real personal to me real fast.
Yeah. My father was in the Second World War. He was blown off two different destroyers in the Pacific. And that generation, I feel sorry for it because they didn't understand what PTSD was. They had no clue about the psychological and emotional damage these guys, kids, in many ways, came back to live. And I remember him sobbing occasionally uncontrollably, and we'd ask him, "What's going on, Dad?" And he would have a memory of some friend dying in a war or something like that. This is something that we are addressing more with our servicemen, but I guess you came back with PTSD as well, huh?
Everybody's got PTSD. Everybody's, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. Well, yeah, I realized I had lived a disordered life after a period of traumatic stress. But if you had told me I had PTSD when I first got back, I would probably have slugged you. So, you know, I felt like it had been a mostly positive experience. You know, I got to do a lot of good in Vietnam. I was a project officer on a leper village. And in fact, the most scared I ever was in Vietnam was splitting a jug of rice while I'm off the same straw with the chief of that village.
Oh, that is
quite, you know, I really did not want to do that. And my friend who was with me there, Bob Reed, who was a Christian and Missionary Alliance missionary, he was our partner on that leper village. And, you know, I said, you know, and I'm sitting there drinking the rice wine off the straw. And I looked at him and I said, "You're not drinking it." And he said, "No, he knows my religion forbids me to drink alcohol." And I'm like, "Yeah." Lucky you.
As a young serviceman, obviously you were in the Army long enough to be educated and trained as a serviceman and a warrior. But when you were over there and you're in the thick of it, I guess you don't really think, you're just reacting most of the time. But I mean, you were in some fairly serious battles, weren't you?
Yeah, quite a few.
Yeah.
And I was in Tet. That was the biggest one I was ever in. Mostly they were just small unit. You know, we'd be on patrol and somebody would ambush us and then we would shoot back. And if there weren't very many of them, we would run them off. You know, the ambushes. And then in the first tour, it took me 4 months, but I got my intelligence networking and, we didn't get ambushed anymore. We ambushed them.
So what is, when we hear the term special ops, what were your special ops?
Well, okay, this was really early in the war, and it was the basic special forces. Okay, it was called a Civilian Irregular Defense Group program. And basically what we did was I took over a camp. I was the XO, the second in command the first time. But we had a camp which was in a Montagnard village, which were pretty much a Stone Age people. We had about 350 of those guys that we had trained up to as a strike force. And we had an entire province to operate in. There are 44 provinces in Vietnam. We had one of those. And we started out just basically walking around in the jungle till somebody shot at us, and we'd shoot back, and usually they'd run off. And then the last couple of months, we were doing the ambushing because we knew where the infiltration routes were, and we knew pretty much when they were going to be there. One of those ambushes, There were three trails down by a bridge a little south of our area there. And so I set up ambushes on all three trails. Nobody came down the trail that I was on, and nobody came down one of the other trails. We had maybe 15 guys in the ambush, and 350 VC came down that trail. And so our guys just kind of sat there and watched them do it, you know. Wow. I mean, they made the right choice. They didn't initiate the ambush. That one was kind of a wash. And that was my 27th birthday. I felt like I'd been, you know, I thought I was going to get a present, but I didn't.
You must have seen a lot of death in that war, being on the ground, especially in the jungle and the army.
Sure, man.
That can change a young kid. You're 27 and you're seeing people getting blown up and killed right in front of you. How did you end up reacting to that?
Mostly, you understand, I had trained for this. I went to military school when I was 11. And I had 2 years there. Then I had 3 years in a better military school in high school. And I had done nothing but, and I had, well, one of the things, when I joined the Army, I had read From Here to Eternity 8 times and Catch 22 6. So I knew the D.O. and the Charge of the Light Brigade. So yeah. I knew how it could go. So, you know, I was pretty cool about it.
So when you came out of school, were you assigned a major, or did you work up the ranks from if you went to a military school, that's like West Point.
I went to college at the University of Oklahoma, took ROTC, graduated with a commission.
Okay, so you got a commission after, okay.
Yeah, and I was just going to do my 2 years and get out, but I wanted to go to jump school, so I had to, now I'm getting into Army bureaucracy, but basically I had to take what they called an indefinite category to have enough time left in the Army to go to jump school. And I'd already been extended up to a year because of a crisis in Berlin. And so I figured, okay, a year is a year either way. But the joker in that deck is that you had to have at least a year. So if you caught an overseas tour, you had to finish that before you could get out. And I was married, so an overseas tour would be like 30 months. So I went to the Pentagon, and ever since I knew about Special Forces, I'd wanted to be in it. You know, they were the descendants of the OSS Judberg teams in World War II, and their motto was in Latin, but it means to free from oppression. And that seemed like a worthwhile effort to me. That seemed like a good thing to do.
So when you went in, were you a non-commissioned officer?
Oh, no, I went in as a second lieutenant.
Oh, second lieutenant. Okay.
Yeah. Right. And by this time I was a first lieutenant. Anyway, I went to the Pentagon to tell them, hey, don't send me to Germany or some off the wall place like that. And this major said, Lieutenant, we have orders here sending you to the first Special Forces group on Okinawa. Now it's not too late. And I said, no, you just leave those orders. You put me in the Green Berets. I am ready to go. And, I was so happy when I left the Pentagon that I was laughing so hard I fell down on the hood of a car. My life had changed. I had just ceased being, some guy and become an international adventurer. I was totally up for it.
So at the time the Vietnam War was going on, there was a tremendous amount of protest. There was a very big enlightenment in the United States to resist the war, but you were gung-ho.
Well, I was – look, first of all, there wasn't any of that when I went in. When I joined Special Forces, I knew that that SF was operating in – Laos, that was the main focus at that time. This was 1962.
Okay.
You know, the war you're talking about started in 65. I'd already been there twice by then.
Okay. So you're just like when special ops is like helping the resistance, basically, right?
Well, yeah. But the people that we were working with, I like to say that I wasn't really in the Vietnam War. I was in another war in Vietnam at the same time, because mm-hmm. the people I was working with, they just wanted to kill Vietnamese. They didn't particularly care which side they were on, but as long as we would pay them, we were allowed to designate which Vietnamese they killed.
Oh boy. So, three tours equals how many years?
Well, okay. The first one was 6 months. Okay. And we completed that. Actually, we came home on the 20th anniversary of D-Day. Then I caught another 6 month tour, but I didn't finish that because I got shot a couple of times and, I was only there 3.5 months.
Mm-hmm.
Then the third time I was there for a year, but I didn't complete that because I was there 9.5 months and I got shot again badly enough that I was retired, disability retired.
Yeah.
And then I was back again as a correspondent in 73 for a few months. So altogether, I had about 2 years in Vietnam.
That's a lot. You were injured fairly severely that you were retired. I mean, you describe it. It's pretty bad. Where were you when you were wounded?
I was in the Ashau Valley with Project Delta. And we took in a company of Vietnamese Rangers, but half of our helicopter support got pulled. So we had to do it in two lifts, and they took a break between lifts. So by the time the second lift came in, we were surrounded by about two battalions of NVA, and there were maybe 100 of us. So we had six choppers down on the LZ, and I saw one of them go right into the enemy position. So none of those guys could have survived. I was on a kind of a rescue mission, and these guys were trying to escape from a B-52 crater in the middle of the LZ, and they had wounded. So I was firing over their heads, standing on a dirt bank, and I was pretty sure I could see where the enemy had a machine gun, and I was kind of holding those people down. And everybody came through but the last two guys, and one of them got hit, and he needed help to get up that dirt bank. Well, to help him up the dirt bank, I had to quit firing. And the minute I quit firing, I got shot. And I had a severed artery. So when you got a severed artery, you've got like 3 minutes to get a tourniquet on and get that closed off, or you're a goner. So I had to leave those guys. And, I was done with that. There was nothing more I could do for them. And I went and got my arm bandaged and sent people back for them. And one of them told me later that, after I got hit, nobody fired at them anymore. I guess they thought they were dead because they were lying there in plain sight, but they weren't moving. And, so one of those guys survived, although he's going to probably spend nine months or so in the hospital, and the other one was killed. And that was, you always think you're going to get out of the phone booth with a towel around your neck and do something super and save him. I didn't save that guy.
Yeah.
And I still feel bad about that.
So you were wounded severely enough to be retired. What does that mean? The severed artery and your other wounds were severe enough. Basically, they said you're done. That's it.
Well, I could probably have stayed in, but, oh God, this is, If I wander off into the weeds of military,
I'm here to hold on to you, buddy. Don't worry. We want to hear.
Oh yeah, but
we want to hear the war stories.
I could put you to sleep with this stuff, man.
I'll pull you out before it gets to that point. I promise. But we're just curious about
I'd taken a break in service after the first two, and they hadn't figured out what my data rank was yet, and so the board for my promotion to major had already met twice. And I hadn't been selected because they didn't know what my data rank was. And I thought, well, that's it. You know, I knew I was going to have one more board, but I didn't have any more efficiency reports, which was blah, 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 blah. Anyway, I didn't think I was going to get promoted. And in the Army, it's up or out, you know, two passovers and you're gone. And so I thought, well, I can retire and, you know, have a decent income from that. It's not enough to actually live on, but it's enough to, you know, it's something.
Yeah.
Or I can wait until they throw me out and get nothing. So, and then they actually, after I had retired, okay, I say, there's more to everything. I'm an ex-major in the U.S. Army, but I was never a major in the U.S. Army. They promoted me 3 months after I retired and backdated the promotion to 3 months.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah.
And that's how I became an ex-major.
Wow.
The Army has a time machine. They can do that.
This book is your seeking, and we're going to get into your meeting with shamans and things like that. But when you were in Nam, were you using any of the plant medicines that grew freely there, like cannabis or any of that material, or were you?
Oh man, I was straight as a die. And okay. But there was that Montagnard rice wine. I have been told, and I don't know if this is true or not, that the active ingredient is not really alcohol; it's some psychoactive thing. But mostly, it just makes you stupid and makes you throw up. So,
oh, that doesn't sound good. Yeah,
not a lot of fun. It tastes like a combination of alcohol and vomit.
That's not something that sounds very good.
you really don't want it. You really, really, really don't want it.
So when you came back, when did you start experimenting with the psychedelics? Because there's chapters on mescaline, LSD, peyote. And at one point, you're actually using LSD weekly.
Yeah, for a couple of years there. I was in the writing program at the University of Oklahoma in grad school, and one of my best friends in that program was a guy named Zoltan, who was an acid head, and he told me this story about. Zoll had taken a break from the OU writing program, and he'd managed to get into the Iowa writing program, which is the most prestigious writing program in the United States. Mm-hmm. But he thought what they were doing was BS because, it was all experimental. They were trying to do fiction without plots and without just all kinds of weird stuff. And he was, you know, the OU program was, pretty much tightly plotted characters, all of that, you know, all the old stuff. So, but while he was in Iowa, he went to a party at Kurt Vonnegut's daughter's house.
Wow.
And he tripped for that party and they had a blizzard. They have some interesting blizzards in Iowa and they had a blizzard. And he said, well, he was coming home from that party and he said there were cars in the ditches on both sides of the road, and I was going home on the oldest, baldest tires imaginable, but I was tripping, and I was down in those tires, and I gripped the road, and I willed myself home. And I said, I got to try that stuff. And he said, Thursday. and that was that tripping chapter, which I'm real proud of because I knew one girl that read it. It's an old chapter. I mean, I adapted it for this book, but it's an old chapter. And this girl that I used to date at OU had read it And she said, I tripped all night on that story. Just the story. So it's pretty good. It's if you want to know what an LSD trip is like, read that chapter and you will then know.
I was curious about it. When you were taking acid, was it the tabs of sugar or a little nub on a strip of candy buttons? What was it back then?
Okay, we were past the sugar cube era at that time. This would have been 1970.
Okay.
And the first time I did it, I had a half a tab of Orange Sunshine. And that was incredible stuff. Augustus Osley Stanley III had pressed it. You know, it was that kind of stuff. And then the next time I did it, it looked like an aspirin. And my friend who turned me on to that, he was from Texas. He said, have you tried the White Osley? And I said, no. And then I proceeded to try it, and we had an interesting afternoon. And then the third time that I can remember, it was strawberry. And it was supposed to be mescaline, but we think it was acid, and we think it had strychnine in it. So,
So,
a little bit of strychnine.
When you were tripping, then did you have today the big thing when you're using ayahuasca, LSD, DMT, is to have some kind of intention for the trip? In other words, just don't let it happen. Have some goals or something like that. I don't think that was your intention back then, or your even an idea. Were you seeking healing? Were you seeking knowledge? Were you just tripping?
It was both. I knew that I was going to get some insights that I wasn't going to get otherwise, and that they would be spiritual insights. And so I was looking for that, and that was part of what I was there for. But also, I went to a Zeppelin concert. In fact, I went to a couple of Zeppelin concerts, and a couple of Dead concerts, and The Airplane, and Steve Miller, and I could go on at some length.
So what did you prefer, acid, peyote, cannabis? What was your preferred psychedelic?
Well, LSD.
LSD. I mean,
but in most cases, there was a guy showed up from Dallas. Scott from Dallas showed up in a pair of red pants, and he had an attaché case full of blue mescaline, which was quite marvelous. And so that was, it kind of depended on what you wanted to do. If you wanted to just have a good time, I would say that mescaline was the best psychedelic. If you wanted to get insights, then you not only needed acid, you needed very pure, very good acid.
Talk a little bit about, if you can remember, fragments of the trip, because if you're seeking higher wisdom or some answers and stuff like that, sometimes, people talk about and even write about trips that they've had and somebody's talking to an animal's talking, or they're seeing a scene and they're impressed or something like that. Any memories you can tell us about?
Well, probably the most interesting was the time I loaded up on LSD and went skydiving. And even before it started, strange things happened. I was standing there on the edge of the drop zone talking to this guy that came up, and we were just shooting the breeze, and it turned out that he had been on the LZ the very first time I ever made a skydive, which was 10 years before in New Jersey, and this was in Oklahoma. And I thought, well, no, that's really an odd coincidence. And while I was talking to him, a guy named Noki Klutz walked up, and Noki had been my jump master on the first jump I'd made on that drop zone. And since then, he had joined the Army, become a helicopter pilot, and been assigned to the 281st Assault Helicopter Company, which was the unit that saved my ass when I got shot in the arm. And I thought, now that's two coincidences. And while that was going on, Don Robison, who had been my cadet platoon sergeant at the Oklahoma Military Academy, came walking in off the DZ. And I thought, okay, they're trying to tell you something. Something is going to happen on this jump. But these are all good guys, so it will probably come out okay. And so I got out, and I got to shoot out, and I had a right side closure of the canopy. So if I rode that in, I would probably die. And then if I didn't die, I would probably be crippled for life. And it was not a happy coincidence. So I was trying to shake it out, and that wasn't happening. And the guy that was jumping with me knew what I was doing, and he yelled at me, and I could hear him. He said, "Get rid of it." And I said, "Oh yeah, get rid of it." So I dumped the main canopy, got the reserve out, and which lets you in a lot faster, but it will let you down.
Yeah.
And I came into some mud beside a lake. So that was a fairly soft, albeit not particularly sanitary landing. And I survived it. And the thing about that was that I guess you could call it a spiritual insight, which was the end of machismo for me. It was like, okay, if you still got something to prove after that, then the only thing you're proving is that you're crazy or an idiot.
Okay. Yeah.
So that was the end of me trying to prove myself. And that was very freeing.
We're going to take a short commercial break, and we'll be right back with Jim Morris and his new book, The Dreaming Circus. My guest today is former Special Ops Army Major Jim Morris, and we're discussing his transition from a military officer into someone seeking a path, seeking wisdom, and his discovery of plant medicines, other psychedelics, and a path of Toltec dreaming. Let me ask you about LSD, though. Would you say that it came on the scene to enhance a generation's perspective on the human condition?
Yeah. That's one way to phrase it. It made the 60s, you know, mm-hmm. All that good music. I mean, 60s music is still one of the great musical eras of all time. And that was all due to the psychedelics, you know. Mm-hmm. The Beatles were just doing Chuck Berry rock and roll until they got into the psychedelics, and then they went off into Sgt. Pepper and all that crazy stuff.
But for you individually, Jim, would you say that it began not only opening your eyes, but kind of leading you to want to know more about why you're here? And yeah. what your connection with not only Gaia, Earth, is, but, you know, more fulfilling for lack of a better word, a position as a human being here on Earth.
Well, it opened me up to what it opened me up to was what they're currently calling the morphic field. I mean, I began to realize that. I got married on LSD, and it was the best party I've ever been to. But the guy who had provided the LSD who later was my roommate. His name was Bill. And Bill, I met him that was the day I'd met him, but we had a great time, and he did some interesting things, which I can't really describe. And then he left. And so I thought, well, he should be here. You know, he should be here for this party. So we all got together and we intended him back. Well, I would not have been surprised if he had materialized in a puff of smoke. He didn't do that. And I thought, well, that didn't work, whatever. But a couple hours later, it was, 3 a.m, people were going home, blah, blah, blah. And there was a knock at my door, and there was Bill. And I said, so what brings you back? And he said, I don't know. He said, I was walking beside the railroad track about 3 miles from here, and all of a sudden I knew you guys wanted me back, so I came back. And,
that. I like those stories. Amazing. Talk a little bit about discovering Carlos Castaneda in Don Juan. You have a chapter on his writings, obviously. And what would you say the influence was on you?
Well, okay. The Toltec wisdom is just some amazing stuff. And everybody, I mean, Castaneda has his take on it. Miguel has his take on it. And there's about an 80% overlap in what they cover. But their approach is so different. I mean, Castaneda plays it misterioso. And mm-hmm. Miguel is, okay, here it is, blam, blam, blam. Yeah. You know, the four agreements. And the four agreements are extraordinarily powerful. And I'd already read the book and I thought, well, this is nice. But then when I met him and I went back and read him again, and this time I got it, mm-hmm. And basically I just memorized him. And whenever I was not in a good mood, whenever I felt bad, I knew I was violating one of the four agreements. So mm-hmm. I just go through the checklist and figure out which one or which ones I was violating and quit. And my life would clean right up.
That's fascinating. I enjoyed the story of you going to Vegas and interviewing Don Miguel. And it looks like that was the beginning of your inner journey to kind of be or kind of focus on being well-developed on a spiritual level, but also perhaps touching on the shamanistic side of things as well.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Okay. Well, okay. I met Miguel in 2002. And I started with the Toltecs in about 1976. Mm-hmm. I read all of Castaneda, and when I started reading it, I realized that this guy has a very different take on life, and it's interesting. Mm-hmm. And I was a tech writer at the time. I was doing a tech writing job for the post office department, and they gave me 6 months to do a job that I had finished one third of by noon the first day. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to sit here for 6 months and look like I'm doing something. And what I did was I took all the teaching parts out of the first four Castaneda books and wrote a sorcerer's manual edited that into a sorcerer's manual. Mm-hmm. And in the process of doing that, I really learned that system. I didn't understand all of it, but I damn near memorized it. And I started doing stuff in there, going on vision quests and trying to lucid dream and those kinds of things. And I always assumed that I would somehow accidentally meet my Toltec teacher, and it just never happened. But I started reading. I read about Sufism. I read about Course in Miracles. I spent about 4 years on A Course in Miracles. And then a friend of mine was editor at San Diego Reader, and she started just, I was just writing stuff for fun at that point, and mm-hmm. I would send it to her and a lot of other friends just as, hey, this is what I'm into. And she bought it for the San Diego Reader. And then I pitched him on an interview with Miguel Ruiz. And that's how that happened. My life was, I changed my life a lot.
Talk a little bit about your reading and working with the Toltec system prior to meeting Don Miguel, because, you know, in the 60s and 70s, there were just fragments of teachings of these native wisdoms. But what did you grasp on to Toltec systems?
Well, I had to organize the stuff, and I had to, yeah. I mean, there would be paragraphs from that manual that I did that came from, you know, adjacent paragraphs might have come from different books, mm-hmm. but they're about the same topic. And Castaneda doesn't have four agreements per se, but he has several exercises, and I treated them the same way that I later treated the four agreements. I memorized them, and I used them as a checklist. And they were like lose self-importance, erase personal history, use death as an advisor, and accept responsibility for your own acts. Mm-hmm. And the one that did the most for me I quit taking things personally. And the culture I grew up in, everybody takes, if somebody called you something.
You want to go beat them up, right?
Yeah, you want to go beat them up. And this is when you blow it off, man. It makes no difference. What is he? Yeah. He doesn't know you.
Yeah.
So I had done a lot. When I started all that, I was a writer who hadn't sold anything for 6 years. And I couldn't get arrested, man. It was just everything went wrong. And when I started practicing that, I sold my first book. I sold my second book. I left that job and moved up to a better job. Then I left that and went back to grad school so I could write better. And, I was already on the road. I have a cough, which I consider to be a side effect of the antivirus shot. And so I'm going to pop this cough drop in my mouth.
Go ahead.
And that way I won't go off into a severe coughing fit.
Yeah.
But I will kind of look funny because my mouth will be working in odd ways. Okay, here we go.
Let me further investigate this Don Miguel Ruiz connection. When you were working with the four agreements and kind of dipping into Toltec shamanism, were you using plant medicines?
No, I'd blown all that off years before.
Okay.
I mean, I live in California, you know, I smoke a little weed. There it is. But yeah. That was about it. Okay. And I hadn't had anything to do with psychedelics or any of that kind of stuff for decades.
So as you began to have more inner guidance and inner wisdom and meeting Don Miguel, the need for psychedelics was kind of dropped because you were on a different path. Okay. So describe your first journey to Teotihuacan in Mexico City.
Okay. And, well, you know,
because that's a big deal.
Yeah, very big deal. Miguel has devised this ceremony for Teo that takes 3 days to go through it. And basically, it involves symbolically being swallowed by the feathered serpent Quetzalcoatl and sort of refined in his intestinal tract and coming out the other end, which is another head. He's a two-headed snake, as I recall that. And so we went through a lot of changes and amazing changes. And I saw miracles at Teo. I saw entire groups of people develop halos. I did some of the things that Castaneda talks about, but I had never done with Castaneda, which was seeing energy as it moves. And you get off into an area of what Miguel called silent knowledge, and he calls it that because it's just indescribable. You know, I mean, you can't. It's a feeling, and it's a feeling you've never felt before, and there's no words to describe it. It's some of the stuff that Jesus used to talk about, and I don't know anything for sure, but I have a lot of theories, and I have ascribed orders of probability to things. And you could make a case that Jesus was the reincarnation of Quetzalcoatl, and also of Buddha, and also of all of those people. Mm-hmm. And so I can go off into these crazy theories, but I'd really rather not, because I want to interest people in this. I don't want to make them think it's nuts.
And yeah. No, but talk about
later.
Yeah. No, everybody has to figure out what's for them. But when you were at Teotihuacan, did Don Miguel do ceremony below or up above on the Sun Temple, or?
Yeah, we did ceremonies on the Avenue of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
The most of the ceremony is on the Avenue of the Dead, but the culmination is on the Pyramid of the Sun.
So you actually went to the very top?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I did that six times. I mean, I've been to Teo six times.
Yeah, that's a steep climb. It's a monster.
Yeah, it is. Well, the first time I said to Ted Race, who was one of my teachers, I said, you know, this is life changing, but. Because he'd been there many times because he'd been leading trips there. And I said, what do you do for an encore? And he says, it's like peeling an onion. You know, every time you do it, you peel off another layer and you get closer to your essence.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that to be true.
Around this time, you discovered that you had Native American Cherokee blood.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that discovery and how that changed your perspective.
Well, okay. I have two half sisters, but sisters. I mean, they're closest sisters. And a lady from the Cherokee Nation of Arkansas and Missouri, which is not a federally recognized tribe, called my sister. And she was what they were trying to do was to build up their membership and get themselves recognized as an authorized tribe. And they had found out that our great grandmother was a full blood Cherokee. Wow. And we were, you know, my other sister Sandra was, she had built a medicine wheel on Shirley's farm. We'd already held ceremonies there. And we didn't think of ourselves as Indians at all. We thought of ourselves as English, Irish, Dutch, Scottish, those things. And we didn't know we had any Indian ancestry, but we were still interested in it. And then lo and behold, this lady calls and says, hey, you guys are Cherokee. And all of that, incidentally, is quite in line with Toltec teachings, with intent. What you focus on, you will get. We were, even though we didn't think we were Indians, we were focused on that culture. And then this lady called and said, yeah, you guys are Cherokee. I mean,
yeah. Did your sister build the medicine wheel? Because that's, you know, you use rocks and can be a big medicine wheel or a small, but did she make
this a small one? And it was made with logs, not rocks.
With logs.
But Man, my friend Lee McCormick has built a bunch of medicine wheels, and they are stupendous, gorgeous.
My question, though, is: was your sister aware of her native background before when she was building? So that's kind of interesting that she had an interest in that, and then all of a sudden, by the way, you're part Cherokee.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's synchronicity. It's too much coincidence to be coincidence.
Yeah, it really is. Don Miguel Ruiz is a shaman in many ways. Would you say that you have the inkling to be a shaman, to aspire to a shamanistic approach to life? Or is it just something nice to think about for you?
No, it's impacted my life across the board. Mm-hmm. You know, there's shamanism and shamanism. But Miguel is a shaman.
Yeah.
And he's also a surgeon. He has an MD. He was a practicing surgeon. His mother was a curandera, and she taught him. And but he blew all that off, and you know, went into became a science based healer, and then he had a horrible traffic accident which triggered a near death experience, and when he came back he was all different. And then he went back to his mom and said, "Hey, you know, I got to learn this stuff," and he did. Mm-hmm. And he's great. I mean, it would be hard for me to explain how great. Okay, I asked him when I introduced him or when I interviewed him that first time. I asked him, "Well, what's the story on the miracles?" And he said, "Oh," he said, "you know," he said, "I perform a lot of miracles. I have no idea how I do it," and he'd talked about this time he had a bunch of people in Machu Picchu, and he said, and it was night, and it was very clear. You could see all the mountains around there and the stars and everything. But he said, "What would you guys think if in 1 minute this place was so covered with fog that you couldn't see your own hand in front of your face?" I said, "Well, no, that would be cool." And here came the fog. And then he said, "What would you think if in 1 minute it was as clear as it was before?" And in 1 minute it was as clear as it was before. Hmm. Well, he told me that story. But one of my teachers later was Heather Ashimara, who is quite a famous Toltec teacher and a sweetheart. I love her dearly, like I love my sisters. I should be clear about that, but I love her dearly. And anyway, so she was talking about the first time she went to Machu Picchu with Miguel. And I said, "Was that the time he brought in the fog?" And she said, "Yeah, I think it was, but it wasn't the weirdest thing he did." And I said, "Really? What was the weirdest thing he did?" And she said, "Well, we were in a lightning storm, and he would point, and that's where the lightning would strike. He would point, and the lightning would strike there, and he would point someplace else, and the lightning would strike there." And he did this 6 or 7 times. And then he taught a couple of guys how to do it. And so the next time I was talking to Miguel, I said, "You know, you told me about the fog, but Heather Ash told me about this lightning thing. And do you know how you did that?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "I didn't cause the lightning to strike there. I just knew where it was going to strike. And if you clear your mind, so your thoughts don't get in the way, the universe will tell you stuff."
Amazing.
Yeah.
The book's called The Dreaming Circus, Special Ops, LSD, and My Unlikely Path to Toltec Wisdom. My guest today has been Jim Morris. Would you say that with this Toltec knowledge and what you've kind of experienced in this lifetime, that not only do you perceive people differently, you walk a different path than you did as a
young. Oh yeah. And I do have I can't point and make the lightning strike there, and I can't I've never brought the fog, but I submitted this book to one publisher, and I muscle tested a whole bunch of publishers on the internet, and I got no on all of them but Inner Traditions. And I sent them a copy of my book and my manuscript, and 2 weeks later I had a contract. No authors do that. That doesn't happen that way, but it happened that way to me this time.
Yeah, congratulations on the book. Do you work with people who come into your space and if they, you know, appear to need some support or some healing of any kind, do you reach out to them, or are you kind of stay clear of that?
I do that a little bit, but I think of myself primarily as a writer and editor, and I'm trying to see where I'm trying to put together a notion of where I can take this next. Mm-hmm. And also, I'm 85 now, you know, I mean, travel is not as easy as it was. Some things are not as easy as they were, and some things are quite a bit better and clearer, you know. So I have tried teaching. I wasn't very pleased with my own teaching, and I felt that's not what I'm supposed to do. What I'm supposed to do is sit here and bang these keys.
Well, and also get down to Mexico and visit more of these ancient sites. Maybe, you know, you could write about your impressions. We don't have enough of that.
Well, my friend Lee McCormick, I've mentioned him before. He's one of the better Toltec. He's a great Toltec teacher, and he's putting together another trip to Peru. And when I went to Peru, I fell in love with. I've fallen in love with several of the countries I've visited: Thailand, Peru. I kind of fell in love with Vietnam, but I don't. I just don't want to see what's happened to Vietnam. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's got high-rise buildings now. I don't want to see high-rise buildings in Vietnam. That's not my Vietnam.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure, Jim. Can people get a hold of you on a website? How can they get more information?
Yeah, my website is thedreamingcircus.com. And Inner Traditions will shoot any actual mail I get on to me. So all of that's great. Okay. Cliff, I want to thank you for this. I just looked at the clock because I saw you were wrapping up. I thought we were like 15 minutes into this. This is fun.
Well, I'm glad you liked it. And I appreciate the insight. I was fascinated. I've never taken LSD. I was always paranoid of it. As a young person, thought I was already half crazy. And I had heard the stories of people jumping out the windows and running in front of cars and stuff like that. But so I had a tendency.
I never understood that. If you can fly, why should you jump out the window? You should be able to take off the ground.
Well, there's new plant medicines. There's a big one out right now called ayahuasca.
Yeah, I know about it. I haven't tried it, but I know about it.
Yeah, ayahuasca is kind of the new psychedelic, and we have a lot of people on the show here that have done it and have written great deals about it. I'm not quite there yet. Maybe I'll never be there yet, but cannabis seems to be the focus, and I just finished a book on cannabis. So,
well, there are exercises or practices you can do in a Toltec thing that will put you in that place without the drugs.
Yeah, and I'm hearing more about that. But as we're leaving, talk a little bit about that, Jim. So there's a meditative practice that will
There's one that when Castaneda talks about it, he calls it the right way of walking. But I learned it the version I learned is called the sensory walk. And okay, you just start out walking, and the first thing you do is you let your eyes go soft and spread out, so you're not focused on any one thing. You're mm-hmm. just trying to bring it all in. And then you bring in the ears, and then you bring all five, you try and think your way into being actively involved in all five senses. And when you do that, you can't think. You cannot, your mind, you can't think. And when you don't think, you kind of step through a door into a different world and everything looks different. And it's quite amazing. Quite amazing and very enlightening. And there are several of those traditions or several of those exercises you can do that will put you in that place. Somewhere in Castaneda, he says that Don Juan says that the key part of all of this, what he called sorcery, is to silence the internal dialogue.
Right.
He says all the rest is padding.
Excellent.
So meditation can do that, but these Toltec exercises can do it while you're out and about.
Amazing. Jim, great success on this book. I know it just came out. I saw it on Amazon, and I hope you sell a million copies.
I would like that. And thanks for the conversation, Cliff. It was fun, and I hope your listeners got something. They got something out of it.
Great to have Jim on the program. This book just came out. I mean, it was just published a couple of weeks ago, and the Dreaming Circus has a great cover with the a Toltec symbol at the very top, which I've seen in a number of places. Toltec wisdom has been around for a few decades, and it comes and goes, and it people adhere to it in meditative practices, in clearings. I think Jim was talking about how he was doing clearings on friends and things like that. But there's a number of shamanic approaches to sacred wisdom that are Toltec based. And if you do a search on Google or whatever your favorite search engine is, you'll see that Toltecs apparently not only were great artisans, but they also had a lot of great wisdom. If you remember a couple of years ago, and we're going to have Dr. Susan Martinez back on the show later this year, she was a great proponent that the original people who later morphed into the Toltecs came from Lemuria. And there's a great deal of mythology about healing wisdom of the Mu people, because they were apparently the original hominins on the planet. And there's the other rumor is that they came over from Mu before it was destroyed 28,000 years ago, migrating to present day Mexico, and eventually branches of them came in and became Zuni, Hopi, and other Native Americans. So, God, you know, it's really a challenge that we don't have more data on these kind of migrations. It's all oral traditions. And, you know, I honestly believe the scientist in me wishes for more data, wishes for more information that we could verify. Because, hell, some of these oral traditions are wonderful to hear about, but it's like, how in the hell am I going to put this in a white paper, a scientific white paper? How am I going to write about this and look for validation? And I mean, this is the problem I'm having with some of the stories that my mentor, Humbaan Spin, passed on to me. I mean, this book, The Maya Controversy, is a serious work for me. It's extremely serious. And I'm having a lot of people saying, hey, wonderful, we're looking forward to it. But I'm like, Christ, you know, mythology, it's not pleasant to write a chapter without references, you know, because it's like you want to have a foundation behind this mythology, these oral traditions. And this is one of the reasons that our scientists, the archaeologists, the historians are faced and have a problem with asking and working with the Native Americans who are left to us. You know, and I say this a lot, and this has been my my latest beef with archaeologists is that, and you know what, when we had Dr. Edwin Barnard, and what a great guy, I'm so glad he's on the program. When we have Ed, and he admits that it's a huge oversight not to speak with the present day scientists. They're called daykeepers, the Mayan daykeepers, the shaman. What's going on? What did you understand? I got to tell you this too, and this was a shock to me. Before he died, Carlos Barreros, who wrote he was the shaman, and he's actually a member of the Mayan elder council. In his book, The Book of Destiny, Unlocking the Secrets of the Ancient Mayas and the Prophecy of 2012, by the way, you got to get that book. He talks about a number of noted codices that are known by people, and they're kept in Guatemala. Oh my God, when I heard that, and I actually asked him that when I talked to him, you know, and unfortunately, he died before we could do a special interview with him, which was tragic for me because he was a well of knowledge. But one of the things that he told me is that he verified the fact that there are a couple of different codices that are in the hands of council elders in Guatemala. Well, why don't we have those? Why don't we have those documents? Well, no one trusts the damn white man. And the idiots who are historians, and I'm sorry to say this, because they are lacking in brains to not befriend and work with the native people who are still with us to, God, validate the ancient buildings, try to drill down and understand who these pre-Maya were, and also the classic Maya. What is going on with us not talking to them? This is the most misunderstood people. The Mayas are the most profoundly intellectual. Well, I shouldn't say intellectual. They're the most profoundly sophisticated people on the planet. I mean, they are brilliant. We have just scratched the surface, and yet we refuse to talk to them. Having knowledge of a CODIS being available, or more than one, two, is lost knowledge, lost awareness, lost growth and evolution. Because when we find out what the story is with the Maya, then we have a very important part of our history. So, anyhow, it's a challenge to work with the historians. So I'll get off my platform on that one. Anyhow, I want to thank Jim Morris for being my guest today. And again, his book is available, just came out. You can get it on Amazon or your local bookstore. The Dreaming Circus. Check it out. There's a good reference on Amazon that he wrote as a kind of a lead-in that you can check out. So check that out. All right, that's it for this program. I want to thank my guest today, Jim Morris. As always, the team of Ruth Thomas, Mark Foster, and all the others who make up the programming team here on Destiny. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And hey, don't forget, we are on this promotion for our Grand Egyptian Tour for next May. It's the 2nd through the 14th. This is the hottest tour out there. The price is the lowest you'll ever find. Plus, if you want to get an extra few hundred bucks off, send me an email, cliff@earthancients.com, and I'll send you the details of that. We're giving an early bird special, only good until November, but it's a worthwhile discount of enough money that you're going to think twice about not coming. So, hey, if you want to see the itinerary for this tour, go to earthancients.com/tours and check it out. This is a physical, mental, and spiritual transformative tour that you will never forget, I guarantee you. And people who do the tour are shocked and surprised and impressed at everything we do. It's just a mind-blowing, wonderful, wonderful tour. So check it out, earthancients.com/tours. All right, take care, be well, and we will talk to you next time.